So here we are. We're having a conversation.
Yes.
No pressure. So.
How to start?
Have you got any questions or any reflections?
I mean, normalerweise spreche ich Deutsch, but usually
I would speak German.
But sometimes I have to switch maybe to German because I'm lack of vocabulary.
Okay.
But we try to make it in English. So we start a discussion, I think, 2 hours ago, and discuss about the ideas in Germany and the ideas in the British competition. And you took a look on our ideas there.
Maybe I could say something about the British competition, the British project, which started life in about 1999 as an idea that came out of a conversation in a bar, in a pub, in Finland, actually, when I was there at a conference of historians of education. And my colleague Ian Grosvenor, who's a professor of education at Birmingham University, he threw an idea into my lap, just over a drink. And that was to think about the book that was published in 1969 called The School That I'd Like. And that was a little book which, if I would suggest you could look it up, its author is Edward Blishen. And you can buy it from Amazon, often for about a penny or a cent or a few cents. But it's a beautiful little book which came out of a competition that was held in England in 1967. So that's 50 years ago. And the question was put to children of older age group, secondary school children, what would be the school that they'd like. And the idea that Ian put to me was, let's ask that question again at the turn of the millennium to as many school children that we could possibly do. To compare what children said in 1967, published in this book in 1969, with what they would say in the year 2000. So it was always a historical project with a thought to looking at the passage of time and how children's ideas change or remain the same over time. And so I started to use the internet to try and connect with schools across the world, actually, to begin with, to ask them what would be the school that they'd like. And I got some really interesting results, some interesting data, if you like. But then one day I thought, hey, let's try and make this bigger. And I picked up the telephone and rang the Guardian newspaper and floated the idea with them to run a competition, the school that I'd like, in the year 2000. And that's how it started off. So I would say it's always had a historical dimension, the UK project. And it continues to do so because we've kept the material that was produced in the year 2001, as it turned out to be, and kept it as an archive. Because children's ideas are very valuable, and archives are suggestions of value. So keeping children's ideas, keeping this material, is very important for historians of the future. And to actually just see what does change over time. And if you look at the book that we produced called The School I'd Like, you can see what we did was we compared what was said in the 1960s with what children were saying in the year 2000, 2001. And guess what? A lot of it was very similar. And looking at the German project, we found a lot of similarities with what children said they valued in education.
Mm-hmm. So you said your interest is more historically to make the comparison, but my interest on the project was more politically. Mm-hmm. So the question, what children want to change in schools, and the ideas which came in our unsere Schule project were justice, to have more community and not learn individual, to have green, ecological, sustainable schools, to have more movement, to have clean toilets, to learn things which really matters. And I was wondering, where are the problems that these ideas, which are not revolutionary, which are not, yes?
Yeah.
Why these ideas
yeah.
didn't have an impact on the political debate, yeah. on the real things which have to change yeah. in schools? And this maybe would be my question for you.
Yeah.
What with your Wettbewerb, with your project, happens? Mm. So,
yeah.
beside the historical interest.
Yeah.
So.
Well, a lot has happened. Besides the historical interest, I'm also interested in the political questions. And also, I was interested in the things that children said were important to them were quite often material things. Things that you could touch, smell, hear, the sensory, and particularly their drawings and their models about how classrooms could be or how schools could be, the interpenetrability, if you like, of schools, so that they could be accessed easily by members of the community. Actually, some quite radical ideas. The idea of breaking down the walls of school, which is reminiscent of John Dewey's idea of the importance relationship between school and community and neighborhood. So I was also interested in those political ideas. But when it comes to the question of what prevents change, what prevents movement, well, there is lots of change going on. I saw a wonderful school here in Berlin yesterday where architects have been working with children to redesign classrooms and really reshape them and remake them. But at the same time, I saw examples of what children had done to make really comfortable, pleasant, stimulating environments come under stress because teachers need space for storage. So I saw examples of where some of these spaces that children had carefully designed had been taken over by teachers under pressure to find space to store their materials. So those are some interesting tiny examples of how power relations are extremely important here.
Final word, yeah, it's very fast.
It is very fast.
It is very fast.
I've got one more thing to say then.
Please do so.
I think the other thing that matters is that when we think about education, when we think about schooling, we're always thinking about jobs and work for the future. How to prepare children for economic activity so that they can earn a living. I think this is one of the things that prevents us from imagining a different way of being. If education is about finding your talent and your gift and the beautiful thing that you can offer to society, whether it's scientific, artistic, caring, music, if it's about finding your talent, then education and schooling should be perhaps organized so that it doesn't lead to a job for the future, but how you can contribute to society in the future, and maybe needing some kind of economic basis where we have money given by the state to prevent us having to find work would change the way in which school was organized. That's a bit of a radical idea.
Yeah, but maybe I can... I have to add something. Maybe to this idea I have to add something, because for me the interesting thing and the ideas the students and the kids, and especially the youth, sent to us, especially the wish to be prepared for work, not the wish to have a different life or something. It was more the smaller children, but the older want to be prepared for life, for work life.
And maybe this it's because they don't see that there's any alternative
yeah, yeah.
than earning a living.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But But maybe we just discuss this.
We are going to discuss the issue. We are going to discuss the issue of alternate future regimes, visions. Right now with Kerry Facer. I would like to ask you to stay on stage and take a seat in our little living room so that we are aware that we are going to go on with in the conversation. And I would like to ask Kerry Facer. Well, Robert and Kathy gave us the perfect starting point.
They have, haven't they? Can you hear me okay? Yep, okay. Yep.
So, yes. Kerry Facer's book, Learning Futures, Education, Technology and Social Change, was a great inspiration to design the project. So, there are books outside, if you're interested, also John Dewey's. But the central point was that in this book you were putting a lot of critique on this monoculture of a unique future, a future that is driven by employability. And I would like to ask you, why is this so important to develop alternate future imaginations in school?
Yes, I mean, so schools are dominated by the idea of a future knowledge economy. And the reality is there are radically different futures that may emerge. We aren't quite sure what they're going to be. But if we think about it, we have a combination of radical and disruptive environmental change that we are going to be living with. We have aging populations, which will change the makeup of society. We have technological change that might bring, well, will bring different forms of artificial intelligence, machine learning. And we've got radical uncertainty about whether our basic economic system is actually functioning or completely broken. So all of that gives us some very, very uncertain futures. And one of the challenges that we have in our schools and our universities is to think about that not just with fear, not just to be afraid. Because quite often when we think about those things, we tend to think, ah, what am I going to do? And run away. And so the critical thing, I think, is to look at some of those possibilities and begin to imagine different worlds that may emerge and figure out how we can live well within them.
What different worlds, what alternate futures have you seen in the projects that we were visiting today in the test run?
Yeah, so there's some very interesting, the work around sustainability is fascinating. Some of the thinking about the virtual worlds, I was really interested that one of the projects, when asking the young people the futures they could imagine, on one hand we had a sustainability narrative, and on the other we had the digital narrative. And I think that question of how we're going to negotiate the virtual and the physical, and whether they're going to be connected together, is an absolutely critical one. And one of my favorite projects today was one where they were really trying to grapple with how the digital and the physical connect to each other. My personal feeling is we won't get out of the messes that we're in by running away either from our bodies and from the planet or from the tools that we're inventing. The question will be how they can be thought about with each other.
So almost 7 years have passed since you published Learning Futures.
Oh God.
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
I'm
I was
quite old now.
No, well, we have to face it, Kerry.
I know.
Yeah, time passes. I wanted to ask you how your idea about the role of schools and future has changed since then. What?
Well, some of the stuff I'll say that stays the same is the things that you were talking about in terms of the relationship between school and society. So the reality is schools can't fix this on their own, and society desperately needs schooling. So the interconnection of school and society still matters. I suppose some of the things that I would say we need to do more of that I didn't talk about enough is the question of how we live with uncertainty, how we live with radically not knowing what's going to happen next, and also how we live with complexity, so that when we try to do something, unintended consequences happen. And thinking about the ethical responsibility that we have in that situation is very difficult. And what excited me today was to see the prototyping and the way of training and supporting young people to try things out, to take risks, to deal with failure and to learn from it. Because the reality is there are no grown-ups in any of this. Nobody knows how to fix all of this. Nobody's going to come and tell us the answer. So we and the young people have to experiment together. We have to do it fast, and we have to get good at learning from our experiments. So I was so excited to see the real commitment to prototyping and to test running new approaches today.
Our last question before we share this area, the living room area, and we ask the next round. In one of the last papers you sent me, thank you very much, I realized that you were very much reflecting also on experiences in the Global South, on education experiences in the Global South. Why is it so? What do you find there?
I think what's interesting about the Global South, well, you can't generalize. There is no Global South. There is no Global North. But in the West, we are stuck in particular ways of working and particular relationships with the world and particular ideas of time. And we think they're universal. And that's just silly. So we need to remember that there are different ways, some of them in our own communities as well, of thinking about time and of knowledge, and also of questions of hope. And one of the things that I think those of us in colonial countries are having to deal with as well is the end of empire. Many countries have had to deal with colonial disruption, with rupture, with radical uncertainty for many, many years. And they've learned how to maintain hope, even while dealing with huge levels of oppression and of problems. And so I think you can actually learn. We cannot take their ideas and apply them here. That's another form of exploitation. But what we can do is respect the fact that there are different ways of dealing with hope in times of radical uncertainty, and then work out what our own will be.
This is the point where I would like a conference to start and not a project to end, because at this point I would very much like to go on discussing with Maria do Mar Castro Varela, who I hope is still in the room, and with all the young scholars of the Kritischer Bildungslab, who have been also watching very carefully what we were doing. But, well, time is, the time is limited. So,
we'll go
over there, and I want to ask over here, Luis Armando Gandin, who is a professor for sociology of education at the Universidad Federal do Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil, and Robert Behrendt, whom you have seen on stage, and they're going to discuss how to democratize schools, please.
Hello. Hi, Luis.
Hello.
You're here again.
Yes.
Yeah, we had already a little talking and coffee.
Yes.
Together. I had the coffee, you were talking.
Yeah.
Yep.
You got the better part.
Depends. We will see. There were already some subjects touched we already discussed.
Yes.
But still, I remember that you have a really interesting idea about democracy, like two different kinds of democracy you try to focus on when it's about education and democracy. Can you explain this a bit?
Sure. We've been talking a lot about, imagining the future, and a lot of people were saying that what is crucial for the schools of tomorrow is to have a democratic experience. And democracy is one of those words that can mean anything. It's like an empty signifier. Because people put different context of what democracy can mean. And I've been trying to think of democracy as having at least two substances. One that is very thin in the terms of, you go and you vote and you have a committee in the school and you listen to what the students have to say and they raise their hands and you think that's democracy. And that's democracy to a certain extent, but I've been thinking that we have to work with a different kind of democracy concept that is much more thick, and that would also deal with issues of why, and not only with issues of how. We've been dealing a lot of issues of how. How do we do things? And but we haven't been revisiting a lot of the questions, basic questions of why, to whom, who participates, whose voices are going to be heard. So I think that's very important when we think of democracy. The other thing that I think in education, when we talk about democracy, we talk a lot about equality, meaning that we want to give everybody equal voices. But in the complex societies where we live, democracy has to deal not only with equality, it has to deal with difference as well. If we only deal with equality, we always have a problem. So democracy, in a way, has to be a process of not only a redistribution of access, but also recognition of difference, as Nancy Fraser would put it. I don't know, should I keep going, or do you want to ask?
Yeah, go for it, because
I have two more little points that I want to make. One is, also someone mentioned here, and a lot of the experiences mentioned this, the idea of justice, right? And sometimes when we talk about democracy, we don't deal with the issue of justice. And I think justice usually takes the perspective of the least privileged, rather than just taking the ideal of the majority. So I think working, democracy and justice is not that simple. I think we have to sort of put them together. And the final point is that I think a lot of times when we talk about democracy, we forget that when we say, in schools we learn math, we learn chemistry, we learn philosophy, and we do it by practicing. But when we talk about democracy, we usually say, in the future, you're going to go to society, and this is what you're going to do. But we don't practice democracy. So we assume that democracy is something that is going to come magically, because everybody knows what democracy is. And I think in schools, we definitely have to think about democracy as something that has to be lived. And we saw a lot of examples here of the kids talking about that.
And I see the contradiction, because especially German school system is not very democratic from the base. It's like hierarchically built up. And you talked about the less privileged. They should have to decide more and have more possibilities of participation. Participation work, this is one of the special things you do in Brazil, community work. And what exactly do you do in Brazil to make a higher performance of participation possible?
Well, I don't know a lot of experiences, but I know one in particular that as in the city of Porto Alegre called the Citizen School. And what they did is that they put the interests of the less privileged in the center. And that means that, participation is also one of those concepts, right? Participation can mean, let's all participate. I want to buy a car. You all chip in, give me the money, and now have the car. You're participating in me buying the car. That's very, that's a concept of participation. So we need to discuss what participation really means. And participation is also one of those concepts that it's very complicated, because you assume, let's just put everybody together and let's participate. But when kids don't have the language skills, or when when parents come with different kinds of knowledge, for example, we were looking at this project where the kids were talking about how you grow vegetables and stuff. It's very easy to forget that in a rural situation, the parents have the knowledge, right? So the school has to sort of step back in a way, not to say we don't have a responsibility to educate the kids, but we have to put into question what kinds of knowledges, what kinds of funds of knowledge are available for us to tackle the specific problems. And that has to do with thinking of whose voices are heard. And so you have to learn how to do that. You have to, I was talking to you about learning laboratories, for example. A lot of times, learning laboratories are spaces where the kids who are not learning in the pace that the school thinks that they should be learning are taught in a different way. But and this experience that I'm talking about, the city of Porto Alegre, the learning laboratories were a place where teachers also were learning how to deal with different kinds of knowledge. So it's not a space where only we as teachers, as schools, teach communities, but also we learn how to teach this community and how to incorporate their own perspectives inside. But that's not easy, right?
So the responsibility of teachers is more in the frame set? So
teachers have a huge responsibility. Let's assume that teachers now are responsible for providing some of the intellectual and philosophical and practical tools for problems to be resolved in these communities. If you're not a real expert in your area, you're going to have a problem, right? Because usually, if you only know scripted curriculum, you're going to have a problem when you open up spaces for the kids to ask different questions or for the communities to say, what chemistry can help us here, what philosophy can help us here to sort of deal with the time issues. And so teachers have a huge responsibility. And someone was saying that teachers are being attacked, and they are all over the world. So I think we have to understand that that's not possible without collective work, without spaces for reflection, without spaces for sort of rethinking our roles as teachers, right?
So our time is up, unfortunately,
sure.
But I hope we can go on with our discussion.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please share this role with us. The last dialogue is going to be on what's art, what art has to do with all this. And I would like to ask on stage Mai Hazager from the Malmö Art Academy and Marie-Louise Rudolph from Kulturkontakt Austria, the two partner institutions with whom we have been developing these projects. And later we want to have you on this side of the stage as well.
This is the German version.
Yeah, also, wenn es okay ist, würde ich gerne.
I'd like to speak German. I will be capable of having a much more differentiated approach, right?
It's good to be sort of ending note to say what has art to do with this. Most of the projects that we've seen today has been in cooperation with artists, designers, musicians, technicians, and I'm also thinking about it becomes this extra curriculum activities, and in this format also it has the potential to be something else if we dare to think about sort of long-term strategies in terms of implementing art. But I'm also thinking about the responsibility of the artist as perhaps an untrained transformative subject. And I think that could be an interesting starting point to look upon what does it mean to have artists kind of entering the public school system and what could their role be?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the role of the artists, because there are differences also between different European countries. So artists who work at schools need a certain educational training in some countries, in others they don't. Sometimes they can simply collaborate with the students, sometimes they need a mediator. Now, we agreed that artists offer a lot to the students also with respect to how to deal with the matter or the material, not only in arts lessons, art courses, music lessons, but also in subjects which are not about art exclusively or only. They can be models, they can set examples, they can show what you can do. Now, you're working in an institution which involves a number of educational and artistic aspects. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about the aspects which are important for the students and prepare them for certain workshops.
So the critical and pedagogical studies at Malmö Art Academy is a master's program for artists who is thinking like in terms of hybrid practice, so between pedagogy, critical thinking, and artistic practices. Instead of having all these different hats we tend to wear, I'm an artist, and now I'm a teacher, and now I'm a facilitator, and now I'm an organizer. We look at it upon as practice, like one holistic practice. How can we negotiate that space? How can we equip artists with tools for different situations as well, and also allow a space to work through things on their own? So to be between sort of like directed activities and non-directed activities, as well as to look at different formats of learning. Perhaps not always as easy as said, because we are all coming with the particular schooling. So when we enter these sort of spaces, like often then the educators or artist educators tend to be situated around the table and keep the seminar form. So it's also a challenge to just look upon the different models that we can explore. And I mean, this afternoon was a good example of the two-hour workshop that the participants of the Critical and Pedagogical Studies program did, which was a really impressive self-organized endeavor where they activated us and the space and thinking processes and listening process for 2 hours because they wanted to form a response, not answers, but a response or questions to what does it mean to be between art and pedagogy and what are the potentials.
Mm-hmm. Ja, ich habe ja auch an diesem Workshop teilgenommen.
I also participated in the workshop. And this was a very special experience and a very special approach. And I learned a lot. But I would like to come back to the question of artists at schools, because this is also about structures and how we can change structures. We know that you run a number of programs that cover several years. Sorry, we have organized a number of long-term programs, and we also realize that they set up new subjects like radio, for example, or cultural mediation or teaching culture, for example. Now, if it comes to individual workshops or short-term projects, you can't change much in terms of structures. So the question is, can we institutionalize the approach or not?
Touched upon that briefly earlier on today in terms of like, so what does it mean to change the structures? And I gave one example from a Danish context where there was a study from 2012 like seeing like if you introduce art, not just as a subject, but actually in every activity, the learning becomes easier on other subject matters, which is quite interesting. That led to an increase in funding from the Danish Arts Foundation also to create what they called House Artist. So artists are funded by the schools and the Arts Foundation to develop projects together with school, quite similar to this, and it can take different shapes, but always stemming from the artistic practice. And I think this is a way, perhaps, of expanding, so it doesn't just become another project, but actually thinking about long-term strategies. I don't think there's any solution to this yet. It still has the project sense to it, but at least it is, I mean, there's an attempt to implement. And as you also mentioned earlier, there's a huge difference between educational system. I was brought up in a Danish system, and I'm educating in a Swedish system, and just those two systems with close proximity are very different. And then we're talking about the German context. And I think it's just been quite interesting to see some of the struggles and some of the issues that students have brought up during the projects today, but also like sensing some of the resistances and so how are we breaking these sort of like notions around schooling with the experimental school having hours and classrooms and non-classrooms, but still it's sort of aligning to certain structures. And I think that is quite interesting to think through, and it opens a space to think through, to be introduced to all these different kinds of projects. Yes, perhaps you want to talk a little bit about the projects that you have been involved in relation to mm-hmm. to this, the schools of tomorrow.
Yeah.
we invited several projects or artists to develop concepts in order to help us find answers. It was about digitization and multilingualism and spatiality. And for us, it was important to really have the artists be on board. So we did not want to have schools work on the projects independently or themselves. We wanted to have artists involved. I'm not sure whether I should talk about individual projects because you've heard about them already, but I should maybe say that this is also about a process. It's about a cultural process. The development of schools is in the focus in Austria these days, and it's embedded in a bigger process, which is about the development of the quality of schools. And this is also about changing the profiles of schools. And here, there is no doubt that artists and mediators and institutions, art institutions, play a major role. Also, institutions which are near the schools, i.e., this is also about spaces. Maybe you walk by the little theater next to your school each and every day, and you could also go and try and collaborate. Sometimes it's easy to find a good partner.
Please join us on this side. This is the opportunity to open to the public in case you would like to ask, to reflect on what has been going on. If not, I would like to make a last question to you all. Only a year has passed since we started, but the world has changed a lot in this year and we are all facing new challenges. In the political situation, what are your, it's really hard. We are talking about this on dinner all time, but I know it's not easy, but what's your stance on how would you deal with the current political developments if you were a school teacher or a parent and you have to relate to that? I'm not... Neither nor. So it's, I'm dealing with the situation from an institutional perspective. But let's just for a moment make this question and try to have an answer. Yeah.
I think the important thing is to realize we can't ignore it and that students are living in a world that probably seems increasingly frightening. Or where they're being encouraged to be increasingly frightened of other people. And the school remains one of the last public spaces where we can have conversations across difference. And so it seems absolutely essential that we find spaces in schools to talk about what's going on in a way that doesn't simplify what's going on, and in a way that allows us and allows our students to talk through what they're scared about, what they might hope for, and hopefully to talk about it for a long enough period of time to say, so what can we do here? I think one of the big problems when you have so much going on in so many places, Naomi Klein described it as the shock doctrine, which is you make so many things happen in so many places that you don't know where to act. And the reality is you act where you stand. And teachers stand in an amazing place. They stand in a public school space where they can facilitate conversations across difference. And I think the thing to know is if you act there, there will be other people acting in other places. We will not be entirely on our own. Other people are coming, Other people are working, other people are acting. And we mustn't let the enormity of the changes, because to be honest, the politics is just the tip of the iceberg. There are a whole other set of things that are going to cause significant disruption. We can only act where we stand and remember the powers that we have. And I think we do have them. But we mustn't pretend it's just happening out there and it's too big and we can't deal with it. The school is one of the last places that we have, the last public spaces to have these conversations. And I think how schools can act as a public space and then generate more public spaces is really what we urgently need right now.
One of the projects that dealt with, let's say, an asymmetry of expectations and reality in these days, described in a conversation we had in the margins, that at the end the project became anger management. What has started as a democratization process became anger management. Is this something that has shown up in your projects on democratization, how to deal with anger and scare today?
It happened today, yeah. They were really, they did the class by their own, and I was there to be there if they needed me. And then there was obviously the cry for help, because she said, it's so intense. And I was, oh, okay, there's a good experience of about what is teaching like sometimes. It's intense. And sometimes you go with the group, because if you don't, it's much more intense, because you have to work against the group. So at this moment, I took over, and they liked it, that I helped, but I saw that they were disappointed because they couldn't manage it. So, and I think this was kind of an educational process too, to see what it's like to be a teacher as well. So in the end, we came out with some posts on Instagram, and I encouraged them to post about their anger as well, so because it's part of this process. And they were fine in the end, so. But yeah, it's part of the project.
In the case of the citizen school, a lot of time has passed, and there have been setbacks for progressive education in Latin America. So, have you done research on how these deception moments impact in school life?
This is exactly what I'm doing right now, and going back to the question of, you know, what do we do when things don't go according to the plan? I think that's exactly what you do. You go back and you revisit and you look for the examples where democracy was lived in this particular experiences, and you make these experiences more visible, because visibility is all about hope as well, right? We were talking about hope before, and we live in a society, in a world actually, that doesn't create many spaces for hope. And this is very dramatic, I think. If we are not reproducing the spaces where hope exists and where people are finding solutions, like you just said, you know, like you're frustrated and you put your frustration to work and you use the public spaces that the school provide. And so a lot of teachers are doing this particular thing in the city of Porto Alegre, rather than just saying, oh, you know, everything was fine when we had a government that supported us, and now we can't do anything anymore. You do exactly the opposite. You say, because we built something, we are going to keep building on top of that. You know, you don't, you know, hope is very powerful. But hope cannot be this sort of romantic thing, right? Hope has to have concrete, has hope has to know the obstacles, hope has to work within the obstacles, you know, and hope has to understand the limitations. And understanding the limitations is the first part of acting, right? And acting back and creating alternatives and documenting alternatives. And I think this is really important. I think this is probably the most important political project of our times, to document where hope is thriving.
If we connect to the discussion on what art in school can contribute to these issues, what would be your stance? Is it dealing with uncertainty? Is it helping to some kind of anger management or problematic ideas? So what?
I think it would be a stretch to say dealing with uncertainty, but I would say that art could contribute to open a space for alternative discussions, and alternative not in this sort of lightweight, but actually working your way through, because the like material experience or sort of the methodologies that is used through art, I think that is extremely crucial when we're thinking about change is perhaps a big word, but like changing structures and or at least like rupturing the structures that is existing, because it is offering a different way of thinking, different way of seeing, different way of being, and it can be complex and it can be frustrating and it can be all these things, but I think that it lays open a space of potentiality.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, you were the most optimistic of us.
Was I?
Yeah. Was it due to the nice sunset, or is it a historic perspective on?
I should say I said that I didn't think Brexit would happen. they all laughed. You all laughed, but just wait. Nothing to worry about. No, I was optimistic, but. Yeah, we live in a real world, and the question is, how should education be organized to face that world, to work with children who are very, very vulnerable, whether they're 4 years old, 14 years old, 18 years old, the vulnerability of children. You've talked about fear and so on. There's a lot of awareness of mental health issues and a sense that children are struggling, young people are struggling at school, and later as they move on to higher education, there's a lot of concern about mental well-being. And so I think this is connected to the world that we're living in. There seems to be an increase. I don't know whether we're noticing it more or measuring it more, but there's certainly an increase. And so what are some of the solutions? I think we've talked a lot about space, we've talked a lot about curriculum and knowledge, and the projects here are fantastic. I was particularly impressed with the projects that moved out of the school and connected with the community, and the school building the neighborhood coming back into school. But in my country, schools are becoming like fortresses with electric fences around them, and the inability just to move in and out of school. So we've talked a lot about space and place, but I think also extremely important is time. And I noticed that many of the children who presented their ideas in the German project talked about time and wanting time out, more time to think through, spaces where they could think and take time, more free time. And time is extremely important, because time is an aspect of design as well. We design time in our curriculum planning. And so the relationship between time, space, and human life is extremely important. So don't forget about time.
A good moment to say that. Robert, you have been in touch with all the submissions to the competition of ideas, and you were part of the project from the beginning. In working through the materials, was there did you have moments where you thought, "Oh, this is symptomatic of this historic moment," or were you more had you more the feeling of historic constants of even universal constants? Was there something that is symptomatic for this precise situation?
If I show my opinion, then I'm maybe not the most optimistic person here.
I kind of imagined that would be the case.
I mean, I thought about it when you said your first question, and you had a very optimistic perspective on school, that it's a public space and that there's much discussion possible. And I'm working on a school 3 days a week, and there are these spaces which is possible, but there are also power relations in schools which are hierarchically, can't discuss. And this is one point, and I think this point showed up in the ideas of the children. So I said it when we closed our discussion, that there was the wish to be part of a society, and at the same time, the Bewusstsein.
Was?
The Bewusstsein.
The consciousness.
The consciousness that this society doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So for me, this contradiction was obvious in many of the ideas. Mm-hmm. So we want not have too much stress. We want to have more free time. We want to have spaces in which we can move, and we want to have spaces in which we can sleep. And on the other side, we want this to be more powerful, to fulfill the needs of school. And this, for me, was really interesting, to see this wish to be part of the school, the wish to fulfill the Anforderungen,
the demands
mm-hmm. of school and of labor market, mm-hmm. And the wishes which they produce were, for me, a kind of heterotopy to go there to relax and then come back in society, and for me the question opens was our question, the real question, so our school, or have you to think about the school in generally? I mean, Ilyich wrote 40 years ago about de-schooling society. Maybe the question of how we want to learn is a better question than the question about how we can redesign school. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That seems a good final remark, isn't it? How do we want to learn? How do we want to de-school society?
Can I check one last thing?
But you have to find a final word.
I don't think it's a question of either or.
Yeah. Okay.
We shouldn't have to choose in between having a democratic experience in schools and having a very effective and deep curriculum that deals with the issues of our times. I think we have to combine those two things. Otherwise, school experience will be, you know, not very fulfilling, you know. And we have a responsibility to reimagine what are the role of our fields, each of us, in building new tools for dealing with the kinds of problems that we are. And we have to do it in a democratic way. So it's not, we don't have to choose in between those two things, I think. We can do it together, I'm pretty sure.
And the institutions that we have are the institutions that we have. They remain too powerful to walk away from. And what I see all around the world are choices by certain groups to be able to walk away and others who can't. Mm-hmm. And so one of the real challenges with much of the de-schooling work, which I hugely value and appreciate, is what's the new form of institution. Yeah. So when I talk about thinking about schools as public spaces, I'm very aware that they're not very, but they have the potential. Yeah. And I think that's the critical thing at the moment, what Louise was talking about. Where are the spaces for hope? Where are the spaces for possibility? And one of the things that we have with schools is deep down, we know that they should be places of possibility. There's a kind of, whoever you talk to, there's a sense that that should be there. And I think you can use that to crack it open. So absolutely, it's the way we're going to address the challenges of the next few years. Frankly, we should not be asking children to address the issues of sustainability. Mm-hmm. That's our problem now. We need to reduce carbon by 70% in the next 8 years to meet the Paris climate agreements. Okay? So that is not going to be the job of a group of children planting vegetables, however important it is they mm-hmm. do that. That's our job to work on now. However, the school is a space through which we can negotiate so many other issues potentially, and we have to keep it open as a site of possibility.
It's good that you both convinced me of going back to the path of school, because what has informed me and driven me in this project is that I made the experience of leaving school after a dictatorship. And I have seen how schools can be reconstructed. And I think what the problematic situation in Germany is that we have lost all hope in being able to construct institutions.
Sometimes.
Or to reconstruct them, or to redesign them, or to deconstruct them.
I mentioned last time I was here that, you know, we've sort of lost the tradition internationally of student strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think it's a bit of time to support students and young people in schools to refuse some of the education that they're getting, to refuse an education that causes them mental health issues, that doesn't allow them to address certain concerns. So I think it might be time to support them in recognizing that they have rights, and one of their rights is to an education that enables them to live in the world.
Yeah. The Supreme Court of Justice in Germany has just, that is pretty progressive on other issues, just has ruled out, if I read the newspaper right, that teachers cannot, please correct me if I'm wrong, that how is the strike situation with teachers right now? Are they allowed to strike or not?
If they are not employees, if they are Beamte,
yeah.
Then they...
They are not allowed to strike. No. Yeah, so... The kids will have to strike.
Yeah. And they do it sometimes.
And they do it,
there are
yeah.
so many small places where they strike. But
which is where the digital gets interesting, because it's how do you connect up? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this could go off on a whole other.
Yes, at this point, maybe we have a privileged situation in Berlin, because the teachers here are not state's employees anymore because of the lack of money. So they could strike and they could mobilize together with the pupils, with the students, easily by using social media. Yes, they could. So this would not be the first social media movement. I think there were a few in the last 10 years, very hopefully in the beginning, and maybe we have to empower them still.
A lot of kids took the streets 2 weeks ago on Sunday against the extreme right. It was packed with young people taking the streets, so maybe there is hope in this sense.
Yeah, it was a big amusement to follow it on Twitter or wherever.
Great images.
Yes.
The day has been very long. We promised a discussion till 7, but I have the feeling we have reached a point where we have said what has to be said on the project, on the situation we are, and on the task ahead of us. I hope you share this impression. We would very much like to have you tomorrow when we present the competition for ideas, and the president will address the kids that have submitted their projects. So that is going to be quite an important institutional moment. Last year we visited the president with some of the kids, and this had consequences on other projects the presidency is doing. You know, the presidency here in Germany has to live the continuity of state, so it's a very German-specific situation, but, well, it's the institutions that we have, and let's make the best out of it. I hope this is a good ending. Thank you very much. Alles gut? War es okay?
Yes. Yeah.